Hey, just before we get to the show, I wanted to take a quick minute to explain how you can get access to my online course. Since launching the Lifestyle Investor book and the podcast, I've had a lot of people reaching out asking how I was able to multiply my net worth to over eight figures in such a short period of time and how they can start investing just like I do. While the podcast is loaded with lots of alternative investment advice from both myself and my guests, it's not intended to be a comprehensive system that walks you through my step-by-step process. That's why I decided to create the Lifestyle Investor Course, a complete roadmap for anyone who wants to take a deeper dive into the world of lifestyle investing. If you want all my strategies for creating passive income and building wealth conveniently packaged up into a simple to follow course, visit justindonald.com/course for all the details. Welcome to the Lifestyle Investor Podcast. Imagine being able to earn passive income, build long-term wealth, while gaining total freedom from your business or job. That's what lifestyle investing is all about. I'm your host, Justin Donald, and in less than 2 years, my investments drove enough passive income for both my wife and me to quit our jobs. And now I want to show you how to do the same. I want to teach you how to create wealth without creating a job. You'll learn the exact same investment strategies I used to multiply my net worth to over eight figures all before the age of 40. If you want to learn all about low-risk cash flow investing, achieve financial freedom, and live the life you truly desire, this podcast is going to show you exactly how to do it. Today, I'm speaking with Tony Kappel. Tony is the principal and co-founder at Chicago Atlantic Group, a private market investment firm combining deep expertise with an entrepreneurial approach to multi-asset class investing. As a debt investor with over 10 years of experience in the specialty finance space, Tony has completed over 150 deals comprising over $5 billion in total credit. Prior to founding Chicago Atlantic Group, Tony was a managing director and head of underwriting at Stonegate Capital, a private credit investment firm that specializes in the cannabis industry. At Stonegate, he was responsible for credit, underwriting, and the growth strategy of the loan portfolio. Tony is an unbelievable source of information when it comes to understanding loan and fund structures. He knows exactly what to look for when it comes to protecting the downside and mitigating risk. He's also a wealth of knowledge when it comes to enhancing a deal and creating opportunities to earn better returns, or what I like to call income amplifiers. And today, you'll hear us talk all about it. We dig into debt structures, strategies for de-risking a deal, how to negotiate better terms with things like equity kickers and liquidation preferences, and why regulatory arbitrage is creating a massive opportunity in the cannabis industry. That and a whole lot more. One more thing before we get to today's interview. Tony has a gift for Lifestyle Investor podcast listeners. To better understand the major investing opportunity that exists right now in the cannabis industry, Tony and his team are sharing their market analysis and insights with you. If you want to better understand regulatory arbitrage and why so many investors are making massive returns, go get his free report. To get access to the offer, visit justindonald.com/40. Thanks for listening. And without further delay, my conversation with Tony Kappel. Hey, Tony, I'm so excited to hang out today. I am so appreciative of you making the time because I know that life is crazy and busy. And in your world, you're experiencing some of the most success and exciting things that you ever have. So thanks for making the time to be on the show today.
Well, thank you for having me. Happy to be on.
You know, it's really fun getting a chance to, you know, really get to know each other over the last number of years. And it's cool because we both have a mutual friend. Our friend Brian Rayner actually connected us. And, you know, he felt like you had, like, I just had to meet you. Like, your level of expertise in the world of underwriting is second to none, and that you are just a wealth of knowledge and that you have expertise in some pretty niche markets. And he's right. I mean, I have just thoroughly enjoyed getting to know you and picking your brain. I mean, you love to share the knowledge you've accumulated.
No, absolutely. And honestly, you know, thinking back to when Brian made the introduction, I mean, you never know what anything, you know, what will lead to what. And, you know, I still remember waiting to connect with you. I think you were on a European, a mini road trip through Europe. And, you know, we had, I think it must've been July or August when we connected. And, you know, the feeling is mutual. I mean, the network that you have and have built and continue to build is second to none. And no, it's been great, you know, great knowing you and great doing business with you.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it. I've had a lot of fun. In fact, we've had some great results together. There's no doubt about that. And we've met some cool people together. And, you know, it's really fun when you share a law firm as well that, you know, you trust and is top of their trade and their craft. And that just gave me a lot of confidence as we moved forward, you know, really in the introductory stages. But it's been fun. You know, when I think about you and I think about kind of how you got started in the business world, you really got your start in lending, right? And in underwriting deals that you have this level and this sophistication in the world of debt that not most people have, because you can be a lender. That doesn't mean that you understand what goes into these structures and how to actually underwrite and analyze these deals and protect yourself. I'd love to hear kind of your level of expertise and what you've done and how you got started.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So I started out at Wells Fargo Foothill, you know, and, you know, at the time was one of the, it was known as the lender of last resort, at least from the banking world perspective. And it was in the asset-based lending market. So these are companies that either they want more leverage than a commercial bank is willing to give, or the business is in a transitional period that needs, you know, a specialty structure. And so I started, it was a collateral examiner. So I would be the guy or the analyst that would go on site to the business and do all the due diligence for the underwriter prior to doing a new loan. And so I would go kick the tires. I'd spend a week or two at a company, write my report, and move on. And, you know, out of college, it was, I couldn't think of a better first job, because I would go to 20 to 30 companies a year. And you specially focus on, you know, cash flow, collateral. Why is that business successful? What are the pitfalls? And you would just go and move on. You move on. So it could be auto manufacturer, tier one or tier two. It could be cheese manufacturer, distributor. I mean, you name it. I did about 120 some deals while I was there. And so that was an incredible experience. You know, we learned a lot. And I guess you could say, fortunately or unfortunately, I went through the GFC or the global financial crisis of 2008 with them. So I had the luxury of having to liquidate a few companies, I guess you could say luxury or burden, but that is an incredible learning experience. And you see kind of what things are worth in the worst of times. And you know, it was a incredible learning experience, but that, you know, was very valuable.
I was going to say, and you got it early in your career. Like, what better timing to see that early on? That's powerful, because you're seeing what, you know, typically is going to happen under normal circumstances. That's how most people analyze a deal. But what you want to do is you want to stress test that deal. And once you are able to see a deal and see the stress and how that impacts a company over a financial crisis, over a recession, over just anything that could be a huge burden or could trigger a collapse, you then become that much better to structure all future deals.
Absolutely. And investing, whether it's debt or equity, it's not something you learn in a book. You know, it's experience. And, you know, every deal is different. Every situation is different. Every context is different. And it really matters is getting a lot of at bats and being through from cradle to grave in these deals. And so that I just had the fortunate experience of being in great deals and tough deals, and that really adds to your overall, let's just say, toolkit to know what to do if and when something happens, but more so know what to do so it doesn't happen again.
Yeah. And you had mentioned here, this is a good point. You specifically said there are debt deals and there are equity deals. And I would venture to guess, as you know, you and I would say, well, those are two opposite ends of the extreme. I would venture to guess most people probably don't know the difference between the two or the fact that there is two different vehicles here. Can you elaborate on that for our audience?
Yeah. So, I mean, really debt, you think about it as the bank, right? Who's the lender on your mortgage, the bank on your mortgage, or in this case, lender to the company. They are the first to get paid, or in what's called the waterfall or the liquidation preference. And therefore, they're entitled to a lower return. That's why it's 3% for your mortgage or 4% to borrow for your company. Because if anything goes wrong, they're the first to get paid. And thus, it's a much more protected position. Equity, on the other hand, is the last to get paid, but you're entitled to the upside. And that is really there's a lot of nuance in between, but those are the primary differences.
And there are certain investments that are going to combine the two, where there's a debt component and there's an equity component. And there are a lot of different ways to kind of construct one of those deals, but that's something that you often have employed in the past and currently employ in some of the investments that you do today, right?
Yeah, no. So really, you know, what we have done today, and you know, we built a firm and we seek out what we call inefficient markets, where the demand for capital far exceeds the supply, which creates a very in this case, a lender friendly environment. And so because the demand is so high for the capital, and in some cases, we're able to not only charge above market interest rates, but we're also able to get a piece of the company through warrants or through membership interests or other instruments like that, where it's just an added kicker and upside to your position. And again, there are not many industries and areas where you're able to do this. It's just about finding that inefficient, market to do it.
Yeah, that's awesome that A, you found it, and B, that the gap is so wide. And we're going to talk about this a little bit more. But before we dive into that, you moved from Wells Fargo, if my memory serves me correctly, to a specialty firm, a very well-known, like high-end brand. And talk about your experience there.
Yeah, no. So, and prior to that, I was at a middle market bank in Chicago area. You know, we did a lot of asset-based deals, but we also did a lot of workout deals, which are the deals that go from commercial to a different department because they run into trouble for one reason or another. So there we, you know, learned a lot of how to deal with those situations. But most recently, I was head of credit and underwriting at Stonegate Capital, which is a lower middle market specialty finance fund in Chicago. And we would do the businesses that are a high growth, sponsor-backed, negative cash flow. Those, you know, would be doing a senior debt deal within the assets. We would also do distressed turnaround in special situations. And then also some of what's called rediscounting software loans. So these are, we'll call esoteric credit classes that a bank cannot do, and we're able to charge for the added risk that may be inherent in the deal.
Perfect. And you mentioned senior debt, and that just means you're in the first position, the best position, the one that will be paid out first should the deal not work out. And even if the deal does work out, you're in the first position. So I think that's a very important point there. And it's great that you had the experience. I mean, you had the experience of super conservative. You worked for a bank. Banking, you know, these are Wells Fargo. This is like a conservative bank that's going to be by the book. And then you've got this specialty lending shop where you're doing a lot riskier stuff and you're, you know, investing or lending to companies that are, you know, high risk, high growth, operating companies. I mean, a whole bunch of things under the sun, but I feel like what a great cross section of experience that you got doing that before you went on your own and started your own organization, right?
Yeah. I think like any investment, it's at bats and experience of doing deal after deal after deal. And, you know, for every deal you do, you probably look at 15 to 20 deals that you don't do. But that entails an education process. Why does this deal make sense? Why does it not? So there's a significant amount of, you know, businesses you learn about through that process. And again, it's all about, you know, debt is about structuring the downside. There's a, you know, you're there. It's about how much money you don't lose versus really how much money you make. Whereas equity is really the opposite.
Yeah. So I love that emphasis on not losing money, protecting the downside. That is a total debt play, a total lending operation where you want to make sure you're not losing money. You're okay with not as big of a return. You just don't want to lose. And I think that's a great point. Now, you had mentioned earlier that you underwrote 120 deals while you're at Wells, and I know you underwrote a ton of deals, you know, at various other places. I'm curious, though, of the number of deals you underwrote. How many deals did you actually look at? Like, how many things came across your plate?
Well, you know, I would say, I mean, it has to be in the thousands by now. And you know, it's funny, you see deals. And, you know, you may not spend a lot of time on, may not do it. And then you see it a few years later in a news release and you think, I remember that name somewhere. And sure enough, we looked at it for one reason or another. But the one thing that I've been unfathomable about the United States is that there are so many businesses and companies in this country that there's an endless amount of opportunities. And that's one thing that it's crazy because you would think at a certain point you'd run out, but it's not been anywhere the case.
Yeah. And, you know, it's great that you're taking all this experience, but your foundation, we didn't talk about. You graduated from a very prestigious, very well-known business school, University of Chicago, Booth. And you met some incredible people while you're there. You met your business partners while you were there. You met friends and colleagues and advisors there. And I'm curious about that experience because I've just heard nothing short of tremendous things about the education there.
Yeah, I have a lot to owe to the school. It's funny. I'm lucky because my wife effectively made me go to business school. I would have never gone if it wasn't for her, you know, pushing me and in fact, may giving me no choice. So I had to take the GMAT. I had to do all these things that I didn't want to do. And ultimately, I didn't think I could get in either. That's just all those things were working against, her. But she prevailed and for the better. And ultimately I met my two current business partners there, John and Andreas, who again, we built a pretty nice firm, and without having such a strong cohesive team where everybody kind of works and complements each other, you just can't do something, you know, as great without having that recipe. So have a lot to owe to the school.
Yeah. And it's great because, I mean, it's a lot of work to get into any business school, but to get into one of the top in the nation, to get into Booth, you know, you've got to do your homework. You've got to, you know, you've got to commit to the work, and they are very selective. So, and I've had the luxury and pleasure of meeting both of your partners and just think the world of them. And really what I think is cool is how each of you complement the other person so well. And we can definitely get into that, but I guess we're at the point now where you have all this experience. You're about to embark on this journey of starting your own business. And I mean, that's got to be nerve-wracking. You are going into uncharted territory at this point, and you start a specialty asset management firm that specializes in the cannabis industry. And I would think most people would say, Gosh, Tony, that's out of left field. Are you sure that you want to do that? Because you started early on. You started before the buzz and the craze in this industry existed. So I'd love to hear that story.
Yeah, no. It's funny because, again, without the right people and the right recipe, you know, certain things just never happen. And so, you know, really started at being at Stonegate and just seeing some of these businesses. This is in 17 and 18. And, you know, you see that here is an incredible opportunity. This industry is still illegal from a federal perspective. There's incredible growth that is coming ahead. And so while you look at the non-cannabis industry, there's just so much capital in the system right now. And so what's happening to a lot of deals are becoming, you know, the structures are getting looser, leverage is going up, returns are going down, and that's all a function of just too much capital in the system versus underlying credit risk. And so we started to look at some of these other businesses. Now, we could never do them because of our LP base and we had background bank leverage and so on. But here was an opportunity like, hey, you can specialize in a growing market that's arguably uncorrelated to the greater market, but then bring institutional, you know-how, policies and procedures and build a real firm. And like I said earlier, it's an inefficient market where the demand for capital far exceeds the supply, but you're able to generate far above market returns because of, in this case, it's a regulatory arbitrage. So it made all the sense in the world. I decided to leave Stonegate. And it's funny because I told John, my current partner, hey, this is something we should look into. And John built a pretty large hospitality business, and he's used to operating in one of the most competitive markets in the world. And again, he's looking for that inefficient market. I told him about it thinking, you know, there's no way I would ever do it. But he said, yeah, let's do it. And he didn't even think about it. And I'm like, whoa, you know, like, I don't know about that. And so ultimately, that is what kind of made it so that, you know, John is the entrepreneur to the core and ultimately had the vision where, you know, I'm more of the banker, lender, you know, let's say the sky is falling guy. He had the foresight to kind of see forward much further than me. He convinced me to then ultimately leave and get this started.
Well, it's great because you say no. That's your job. Your job is to be as critical of every investment that there is. You go into it as this can't work. And if I can prove the fact that it can, then this is a good investment. But you go into it saying, no way, this is a bad deal. Everything's wrong with it. It can't survive for so many reasons. And then you kind of work against that mindset and that theory. And I think that's great.
Definitely. And one thing, I'll take it a step further because, you know, right now with our investment committees, myself, John and Andreas, and there'll be other people coming on soon, but we have such different backgrounds and perspectives and things that I like, that John hates, that he likes, that Andreas likes, and so on. And so we have a very diverse investment committee. If you go to most investment firms or even finance firms, it's very myopic. Everybody looks at things the same way because they all came from the same background. It's what is the cash flow? What's the collateral? You know, it's the only one way to look at it. In the case of cannabis, it's such an operationally intensive business that having the operational view versus the financial or collateral view is just as important, if not more important, when determining winners and losers. So John brings a view and an experience to our team that I think separates us from other people, because he can go in, he can see, you know, how is everything flow? What is the production? What's the cost of production? All the things that may not show up in a financial statement, but really is what matters at the end of the day. And so we have done some deals that I had trouble with in the beginning, but John convinced me because of X, Y, or Z. And these deals are turning out to be incredible deals because we have warrants in some of them, and we're going to get paid an amazing return on a risk-adjusted basis, given that we're senior secured debt.
Yeah, that, and I definitely want to dive into some of these terms you're using, some of the perks, some of what I like to call, like when you look at a deal, There are certain ways that you can amplify the deal, amplify the terms, amplify the income. So I call them income amplifiers. So I really want to dive into those. But before we do, you mentioned something earlier that I think is really important, and I want to kind of capture this. You said something that you really love about the cannabis industry is regulatory arbitrage. And I think in order to do this topic justice, because I think this is one of the greatest keys, one of the biggest perks, one of the I mean, this is the reason that this is so lucrative. I'd like to dissect this a little bit with you.
Yeah, absolutely. So what that means is, you know, and for everybody's purpose, cannabis is still considered illegal on a federal level. But we all know that there are various states, I think about 40 states now have some form of legalization. Now, the federal government has not done anything from an enforcement perspective. And that's, you know, for, you know, a long period of time. So while it's still considered illegal, they haven't done anything enforcing it and so on. And so because of that, all of the traditional capital providers are not in the space, whether it's banks, whether it's institutional investors, just all the capital that is just shut out. So because of that, there's a capital starved environment. And so ultimately, because we have capital, we're able to generate far above market returns because a lot of people are not allowed to invest or are afraid to invest because of the perception of that, you know, that differential between federal and state legality. But that is a perfect scenario where I think we are very comfortable that this market's only going one direction. It's not a matter of if, but when it's fully legal. And because of that, we're very comfortable doing deals, specializing, learning, and building a real firm while people are still worried about it. And then that's why we're able to generate such high returns.
And you're able to generate high returns because they're willing to pay abnormally high interest rates. And the reason for it, and I think sometimes people look at this and they say, oh man, you're gouging the cannabis industry, but that's actually not it. The reality is they would rather pay a high interest rate than give up the equity in their company because they're growing so fast. These are like, you know, quarter over quarter, like massive, you're talking 30% growth, 25, 30% growth, quarter after quarter. I mean, it's the industry is just booming. And I think it's important for people to realize that this is a win-win situation. It's a win for the cannabis companies that don't have to give up equity or don't have to give up as much equity. It's a win for the company, you know, for your specialty firm. And then it's a win for the investors because they make abnormally high returns then as well. And so what a cool just way to kind of connect those three different areas, those three different groups that generally are not aligned.
Absolutely. And one thing, and this is one thing, and it's a simple concept, but that they forced the concept into your brains at business school, and everything is about opportunity cost. In the case of the borrower, like you said, they can borrow at 12, 13, 14%, or they can sell a piece of their company, which then is ultimately way more expensive. So they do this by choice. They want to do this, but they are borrowing at these higher rates. The return on the capital they're getting and using is significantly more than what they're paying us. They may be buying another company or a dispensary or a cultivation facility. They're going to be generating 50 to 100% returns for their equity. So paying us a higher amount, it doesn't matter because the equity is the beneficiary of that spread of return. And that's why it all makes sense. But everything needs to be priced off of opportunity cost. And that's really the way to look at something.
Yeah. And you talked about the spread or the delta, that margin of difference between what you're paying for money and what you're earning with that money. And that's the name of the game in everything. That's the name of the game in real estate. It's the name of the game in cannabis. It's the name of the game in running a company. It's about repurposing the dollars that you borrow or the dollars that you have invested and generate a greater return than the cost of that capital. And you guys not only do a great job of really purposing capital well, but you do a great job of finding companies that are poised to expand at a rapid clip. And, you know, I think that that's tremendous.
And to that point, you know, if you look at one of the things in lending, you ask yourself, what is the use of proceeds? You know, that's an important fact. In this case, virtually every single dollar that we're lending out is for growth CapEx or mergers and acquisitions. Those are both highly accretive uses of capital. And so that is a great thing to be financing because you're ultimately adding value to the business that you're giving money to, which further mitigates your risk and maybe makes you more money because you have an equity kicker or something else along the way. The flip side of that, let's say you're financing a dividend. Well, if someone's taking money out, it's not a great signal. And it's a worse reason to be financing a business. So that's an example where, because there's so much growth that's going to be ahead of us for the next 5 to 10 years, it's great to invest in a rising tide environment. Whether you're in, it doesn't matter what industry you're in, it's a lot easier to be right, but it's also a lot easier to make an outsized return.
Yeah, great points all the way around. And I want to give some props to Andreas, one of your other partners, because he is quite possibly one of the most brilliant people I've ever met. I mean, that guy has a mind that works at a level that my mind cannot fathom. And this guy, I mean, to give some perspective, this is a guy that is not a lawyer, but has studied law and has studied contracts at such an in-depth level on his own time, on his own accord, that he knows more than a lot of attorneys out there. And he is often proving attorneys wrong that are you know, kind of questioning his decisions or the way that he's interpreting terms. It's really just fascinating.
He's definitely loves to read. And if he doesn't know something, you can bet that he's going to read until he knows it and will know it in the morning. And, you know, one thing I tell people, and, you know, in, you go back to the Stonegate days, you know, most of the legal and the credit decisions would always go through me. And I was kind of a one man show, you know, to a certain extent. Here being on some of these credit agreement calls, I've never felt more ineffectual in my life. And it's ultimately a great thing because I don't like to do it anymore. And so he's way better at it. And it's just been very vital because these loans and these structures are so complicated in this industry, much more so than the non-cannabis world. So it's worked out great. And again, he's been a great addition to our partnership because he is, you know, he's does so many things great that myself or John doesn't and vice versa.
And the way he can crunch data is just out of this world. So, just all hats off to him, all the praise in the world, and just to your team, the way that you guys operate and your strengths. It's really cool. I want to get to a couple of things. So, number one, when you look at a deal, when you look at investing, so for me as an investor and for our audience, as they are investing in things, there are two things that I talk a lot about. One of them is protecting the downside, protecting the risk, de-risking a deal. The other one is enhancing the upside, creating more opportunities to earn some better returns. And so, you know, in my book, the second, you know, the Lifestyle Investor, the second commandment is all about de-risking the deal. And then the sixth commandment is all about income amplifiers. And so I want to tackle both of these with you because I think you do them brilliantly. And let's start first with the upside, because you've mentioned a bunch of terms that just are music to my ears. All right. You've mentioned equity kickers. I love equity kickers. This is like one of my favorite things to negotiate in a deal. And you've talked about warrants as well. And I think it would be great to kind of hear the difference in those and why you might want one or over the other, and when one is applicable and one's not applicable. Because basically, in either case, you're getting free equity, or you could execute the option to get free equity. So let's talk about these.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, I would say the majority of what of equity kickers were able to get are in the form of a warrant, or what a warrant is, an option to purchase. And if you think about it, let's just say, for an example, you have a company that is trading at $10 a share. Let's say we do a loan to that company, and today we're entitled to 10 warrants at $10 a share, because that happens to be the share price at the time of the deal. Now, that is not always the case. It's just a prime example. Let's say the loan is a three-year loan, and at the end of 3 years, the company is now worth $20 a share. Well, we have the option to purchase that company at $10 a share, and it's trading at 20. So we would then make the spread between our strike price and what the company is worth at the time of exercise. And so that is what would be a warrant or a stock option, which again is the majority of what we're able to get. The reason that that's what we're getting is because it's easier to sell to the company that, hey, I'm putting money in now, I'm investing in the debt, but I want to participate in some of the upside, a small piece of the upside that I'm helping create. And so you're not coming in at zero, you're not coming in at a dollar, you're coming in at 10, which is that price then. And that's really why options or warrants are really the predominant form of equity kicker. Now, sometimes you'll get what you actually get equity in the company. The reason we're not getting that is that it creates more tax consequences for us as the fund and as the firm. And we would rather not, you know, create any tax issues, you know, by doing that.
Hey, sorry to interrupt. I just wanted to take a quick minute to tell you about my online course. As a listener, you probably know my story. In under 2 years, I had multiplied my net worth to over eight figures, and my investments were generating enough passive income for my wife and me to quit our jobs. Since launching the Lifestyle Investor book and podcast, I've had a lot of people reaching out asking how I was able to accomplish this in such a short period of time and how they can start investing just like I do. My methods are unconventional, but I've always wanted to share my strategies and help as many people as possible accomplish financial freedom. And while the podcast is loaded with lots of alternative investment advice from both myself and my guests, it's not intended to be a comprehensive system that walks you through my step-by-step process. That's why I decided to create the Lifestyle Investor course, a roadmap for anyone who wants to dive deeper into the world of lifestyle investing. Anyone can use my system, no matter what level they're at in their investing career. So if you want all my strategies for creating passive income and building wealth conveniently packaged up into a simple to follow course, visit justindonald.com/course for all the details. Now, let's get back to the show. And that makes sense on a lot of levels. Another point that I want to bring up about the difference with equity kickers and warrants is, you know, if you're starting a new business or if you're buying something out of bankruptcy, it's a lot easier to issue equity at that point in time when there's no sales versus a company that's already operating, there are sales, right? So there is kind of like a value to the company. It's hard to assign that equity. So it's a lot easier to kind of go with the warrants and say, well, here's your strike price. And you would only execute then if it makes sense in the fact that the shares would sell for more, right? So it'd be, in many cases, people would wait, you would exercise that option at the time that it was, that there was that delta and you're going to make a margin, and it would be kind of like a cashless transaction, right? It's not like you have to put in, 1,000 shares times, $10 a share. You would just make the difference in the strike price and that current price.
Yeah, and that's called cashless exercise. But all deals, it all depends on how you structure them from the front end. We prefer cashless exercise because we would love not having to put money in. So You know, that's the preferred form.
One of the things I love a ton about what you do, Tony, is, and what I do when I structure deals is negotiating a liquidation preference. And with a liquidation preference, you are basically moving up or down. Ideally, you're moving up in the pecking order of who gets paid when and where. And so I'd love to talk about how you use these liquidation preferences to your advantage.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of like the equity kicker, it's harder to get the liquidation preference. Sometimes it could be in the form of what's called preferred equity, where you may be entitled to get 1x or 2x your money before the common equity gets any of the return. Sometimes that's how it's done. But in general, you know, being in the debt is really how you protect that. So from a liquidation perspective or preference perspective, you get paid 100% in full before anybody else gets a penny. And that's why in the majority of what we do is in the debt, of course, so that if anything does go wrong, we're absolutely getting paid.
And there's a difference also between creating these a liquidation preference on the gross proceeds versus the net proceeds, right? So the net proceeds means someone else got paid somewhere before you did, but the gross proceeds means you are truly first in line. You are the first person to make profit or make money on a transaction. And I know that that would be the goal of every liquidation preference.
And it's another example of that. It's like, you know, people, and we haven't done this and we don't, but people that structure royalties as a percentage of revenue as opposed to a percentage of net income or EBITDA or free cash flow, you're effectively taking your cut at the top line. So before anybody, you know, grabs anything, you're getting paid. And that's why they're very punitive to the company that's paying them. It's what we think of as like, the government in taxes is like they have a royalty on everybody. So they get about 50% of your work, which is just, it's a function of the country we live in, but it's a great position for them to be in.
Yeah, there's no doubt. Now you just mentioned three important financial terms that I think we should actually break down as well. You mentioned net income, EBITDA, and free cash flow. And these are all different, I guess, financial mechanisms or profit mechanisms that you can use to calculate the success of a company. And different industries are going to kind of focus on different ones. You're probably, I mean, though there are investors that really feel strongly on some over the other, but I'd love to hear kind of your opinion on those three and what you prefer and if there is a reason to prefer one over the other.
Yeah, I think from a lending perspective, you always want to look at free cash flow. So free cash flow means at the end of the day, how much cash have you increased? So from day zero to day 10 or day 20. And that means you're effectively your net income after tax minus any capital expenditures. And so what I'm as a lender, cash is king. I want to know how much cash you are making after you pay everybody, because I want to make sure that you can pay my loan back. And I want to make sure you can pay it back in the time that we are giving you. Now from an equity perspective, generally EBITDA is the more important metric. It's important in debt, but equity likes to look at EBITDA, which stands for earnings before interest, taxes, depreciation, and amortization. Because what that means is, you know, what is the operating income of the business? And without taking effect of the capital structure. So take out how much interest it pays, how much taxes it pays, and a few other things that have nothing to do with the operations of the business. Because at that point, you can see what is the earnings power for the business under any capital structure. And so that's really why EBITDA is the more important metric for equity.
And so in what cases do you use net income? Or in real estate, it would be often referred to as net operating income.
Yeah, net income, you know, is really, in some cases, net income equals free cash flow. It depends on the type of business. because again, not all businesses have a lot of capital expenditures or having to buy capital equipment to continue to, you know, our operating assets to build a business. So it all depends on the type of business, but net income is also important because net income could mean free cash flow as well.
Awesome. Now, what other mechanics do you use that help kind of sweeten the pot? Like, how can we create more income amplifiers than what we've just discussed? And by the way, what we've just discussed are great. I mean, if you got just one of those, it could be incredible. But often you guys are getting many of these. And in the deals that I do, I'll often get these layered on top of one another. So is there anything else that we should pay attention to?
Yeah, you know, it all depends. Whenever you're pricing a deal, a big part of it, and this is, and again, I think we spoke about this, Justin, on a lot of our calls, is, you know, psychology is a big factor in investing, lending, in pricing. And so, you know, knowing how your customer, your could be your borrower, could be the company you're buying, how they think and how they operate. And so, one example, you know, that we think at is that sometimes the only thing that matters to the borrower is the interest rate. They don't care about the closing fee or the OID, which is called original issue discount. They don't really care so much about the other fees because they're fixated on interest rate. And so in that case, you're able to have a lower interest rate but have higher fees that ultimately get to you to a better spot from a return perspective.
That's awesome. And those are kind of like the focuses on upside, on income amplifiers, how to enhance the overall return. Let's take the other side of the coin here and talk about how do you de-risk a deal? I mean, one of the ways most certainly is collateral. You would collateralize your loan or an investment. You could collateralize for a lot greater than the value of the loan or investment. I think that is, you know, a real interesting way of doing it. There are other mechanics that you can put into place, but I'd love to hear some of your thoughts on how you do it, because this is really where you are the master, right? An underwriter, an analyst, this is your sweet spot.
Yeah. And that, you know, we spoke about being senior, right? Senior meaning you are the first to get paid in the capital structure. The next piece that goes along with that is secured. So senior secured lending, that's what we do. That means that not only are you first, but you have a security interest or a position on specific collateral. That could be real estate, that could be equipment, that could be accounts receivable, it could be intellectual property, or it could be the stock of the business. All of these are forms of collateral that further improve your position. Like your bank that is your mortgage provider, they are lending you money based on the value of your house. And therefore, they lend you 60 or 70%. And they feel at no point or at very, very low percentage chance that they'll ever lose money because it's backed by the collateral. And so number one is just being secured and being secured at a very low, what we call loan to value. So lending 20, 30, 50% against that collateral value really gets you in a good spot. Beyond that, there are other ways to improve your position. It could be having a personal guarantee from the owner. That I would say it's more so in place for a cooperation guarantee than an actual access to secondary capital, but it's good to have their attention and cooperation if anything ever was to go wrong. Beyond that, it's really what I like to call structuring the covenants in place, so that if anything happens from a financial perspective or anything changes, that you have an ability to effectuate change before there's real deterioration in value in your borrower.
Yeah, that's really good. So much wisdom there. And, you know, when I think about collateralizing effectively, you can have as many forms of collateral as you want. It's all up to kind of the negotiation here. And so you can have something that's 2 times the value, 3 times, 4 times, 5 times. You could have various different things. You could have accounts receivable. You could have real assets. You can have equipment. You can have owners pledge stock of their company. There are so many different ways to do it. I'm curious what's most common and maybe for you, what's most desirable?
Yeah, you know, the most common is what's called a UCC a filing on their business and their receivables inventory, and that's putting on file that you're a secured party, and so that anybody else looking, they will see that you are first position on that business or whatever position, and so that is it's called the Universal Commercial Code, and it's a way to perfect your security interest on real estate. It's either in the form of a mortgage or a deed of trust. So again, that's a filing that anybody can find out and look and see that you are perfected on that spot. So that means they can't sell anything without you getting the proceeds of that, or the sale is null and void, and therefore the buyer doesn't own anything. And so that's really those are the most prevalent. Now, in terms of our structures, we are big believers in stock pledges of the membership interests, and because that's effectively, that's where it's important when you have a business that has, in some cases, more intangible value, where, you know, we're lending to these businesses that have the licenses. The licenses to these businesses are extremely valuable. And again, I'll give you an example. Pennsylvania is a medical only state. And this is in the cannabis industry. There's 26 grow processing licenses in a state of, I think, 13 million people. That piece of paper that gives you the ability to cultivate and sell is worth a lot of money. Having the pledge of the stock of the company that owns that is the best way to be secured from a structural perspective.
Yeah, and these licenses in the states where they restrict them, I mean, these can go anywhere from like $10 million to $70 million for a single license. It's just incredible. And so I get that one of your advantages is targeting operations, targeting businesses in states where they restrict these licenses. I know it doesn't have to be limited to that, but I believe there's just so much more upside and so much more protection when that's the route you go. And you guys are great at that.
No, and that's, again, that goes to lending. You know, you're lending at such a low level to the enterprise value of the business. And that means that they'll never let you take the business. And, you know, we're lenders. We just want to get paid our interest and then get paid back and we move on and do the next. But because of that dynamic, the risk of default is so low because the equity owners will lose so much more that if they end up not paying you. And that's like, for example, we could have a $5 or $10 million loan against a company that's worth $100 million. If they actually default and not pay you, you may be in a better position. Now, that's not what we want, but because of that, it lowers our risk of default, which is ultimately what we're looking for.
Yeah, in other words, if you own a company that's worth $100 million, you're gonna do whatever you humanly can do to figure out what you need to not default. So you have the greatest motivation ever from the borrower. And then on top of that, if it just doesn't work out, you're in an infinitely and exponentially greater position as the lender. And so I love the leverage that exists there. And I really love, you know, it's you're basically creating a contract that is strongly encouraging a certain behavior to take place to honor the deal as it stands. And if for some reason someone didn't, your opportunity is better. And so I always talk about when you're going to lend, I like structuring deals where the second best option is just the original agreement and the interest and, you know, warrants that you structured. But the best option is if they default. Again, you don't want it to happen, but that's the best structure.
Yeah, and again, we pick people and great operators that it's very unlikely to happen because, you know, it's a lot of very timely thing. But think about, like, in real estate lending specifically, you know, the real estate lenders say, would I be happy owning that property for the amount I'm lending? Absolutely. Then that's a great deal. And that's sometimes, that is a really a great real estate lender's, you know, internal underwriting, and that's how they view value. And that is really... you know, a kind of a simplistic way of thinking about real estate lending in that case.
Yeah. Are you getting it at a good price? If you're getting it that far under value, why not? This is a great investment. I love that. So Tony, tell me where the name Chicago Atlantic Group came from, because I love the name. It just has such a cool vibe to it. It sounds very prestigious and very large. And so share that story, because this is a fun story.
Yeah, no, you know, it really, we were looking for an institutional name, or we wanted something that sounded almost like a railroad, like we're playing Monopoly or something like that. And it came together also with the help of, there is another firm who is here in Chicago, that is Chicago Pacific Founders, that I happen to know some of the partners there and our family. And so we somewhat ripped off their name to a certain extent, but just went the other direction in the country. So we were targeting that railroad and that institutional name, and that's really why it came together. And of course, our roots to the University of Chicago and so on had something to do with it as well.
Well, I love it. You know, you've got people and companies that inspire you. And it's cool when you can kind of use that for kind of what you're building your foundation on. And I think that that's awesome. I always say steal from the best with pride. And so, you know, especially when it's just, you know, things like names or ideas or wisdom, just take it as your own. And you can always give credit where credit's due, but, you know, utilize that content. So I think that that's awesome. So you've got this great company. You started with, you know, very few people. In fact, you and I spoke originally, and when we talked, there weren't any investors yet. And in fact, the first time we spoke, the subscription docs were still getting finalized. And so I feel so proud and excited that I could be, you know, one of the first, if not the first, to know you and get to know Chicago Atlantic Group and to really vet this deal at a high level and your company. And so I feel like I've been, it's like when you're first to hear about a band, this local band that ends up blowing up and becoming huge. And so that's how I feel about you guys and your organization. And it's so neat to see, you know, like today having a record day in your organization and on a couple of different levels. And just the clientele that you now attract is vastly different. I mean, you're in the institutional realms now versus just the retail realm. And I think that that's a cool evolution. I just want to pay you props and you know, offer a sincere congratulations.
We appreciate that. And I can kind of tell you, you know, never in a million years would I have thought, you know, looking back 12, 24, 36 months, you never know where you're going to end up. And I mean, you know, we're far in excess of anything that we expected. And I think, again, it's a function of great people, a great team, you know, that cares about creating and building value for people. And then, of course, I mean, you know, Justin, having people like you and early investors is invaluable, because one, you know, right now we have, I think we're over 200 investors, and, you know, we've raised now over $200 million. We have grown through, it's been all organic growth. It's been through word of mouth, through mainly happy investors, like people like yourself. And that's the best way to grow, because it, again, you're not having a what's called a placement agent or a banker raising money for you. It's literally people just being very happy and saying, hey, talk to my friend. And that kind of builds off and it snowballs it builds off itself. And, you know, we have families in Ireland, Switzerland, Monaco, Sweden. These are all people that are in the invest with us that have all been introductions. And it's crazy to think of the people that I've been able to meet along the way. And, you know, it's really about, for us, you know, we are trying to build something long-term and make money for people. And we're looking at 10 years or 15 or 20 years. And so we're not, you know, that's really what matters when you're building, value.
You know, it's so cool seeing where you started with, you know, smaller investors, and most companies, most, you know, investment organizations, they never make it past that. Well, you not only got past retail, and you still bring retail in, but You have family offices that invest with you and your company. You have billionaires that invest with you and your company. And most organizations never have the privilege of being able to attract investors and investment organizations like that. So very cool.
Well, you know, again, I think we've all learned an immense amount during this last few years. If you would have said 3-4 years ago that I would be spending a lot of my time raising money, I would have said you're crazy. But, you know, it's very simple. People have to like you. They have to trust you and they have to believe in what you're doing. And those are the three things that matter. And without one of them, there's 1,000 reasons to say no, but then there's only a few reasons to say yes. And so, you know, getting that right is it's so simple, but a lot of people fail to do that. And again, it's easier and easier to build off itself as you continue to build track record and show people returns and comfort, and it kind of takes care of itself. And now it's a lot easier because, again, it's not a concept anymore. The proof is kind of in the pudding.
Yeah, that's so cool. One last thing before we kind of wrap things up here today. I'd love your opinion of where the industry's going. We all know that it's taking off like a rocket ship, but from the standpoint of federal regulation, there's, in my opinion, and probably in yours as well, there's a limited horizon of time where the way that your company is structuring deals right now is going to end. And by the way, the mechanics you have in place can apply to any industry. You just have a hot industry, and there are going to be plenty of other opportunities even once cannabis is federally legalized. But I'm curious on your opinion of, like, how long are we in this phase where it's super high interest and super high returns with lots of equity kickers and warrants versus when does it kind of compress to more normal interest rates and maybe less of the kickers?
Yeah. So overall, I think there's at least 5 to 10 years of what I would call alpha remaining, which means, you know, the outsized return on a relative basis to your alternative or senior debt in the non-cannabis world versus senior debt in the cannabis world. You know, here we are, this industry now, it's estimated that it's about an $80 billion retail market in the United States. 20 to 21 billion of that is in the state, the legal states, whether it's medical or recreational. And there's 59 or even more than that that's still in the illicit or the what's called the gray market. The transformation of going from a 20 to an $80 billion industry is there is so much value created when that happens. Also, the amount of capital that's going to be needed to make that transformation is endless. And so ultimately, there's an incredible opportunity that rarely exists in your lifetime where I think the last time something like this happened was the prohibition days of going from alcohol being illegal to legal. Everybody did it, but then that time is where you have a dislocation in the market where there's an ability to make an outsized return and be very protected. So I feel that there's at least 5 to 10 years of secular demand growth and overall industry growth that will be far in excess of any other industry. And so, again, investing within that is I think, a very good place to be and allocate, you know, from a capital perspective, whether it's in debt or equity. I think both are prime opportunities. So I think that there is a very long runway. And again, cannabis is something that you want to be with a specialist as opposed to an agnostic investor, because there are so many nuances for people to learn. And it's something that you want to experience it.
Yeah. Caution to just investing in any cannabis company that's out there, because you guys don't do that. The leaders in the industry don't do that. I think that that's really important. But keep in mind that whenever things do legalize federally, I think that there's always this delay, this lag before it catches up, before, you know, the laws around the legalization catch up. So even if something is federally legal, like cannabis or hemp is a great example, hemp is federally legal, though banks still can't lend on it. and it's been legal for some period of time now, right? A couple years or something.
Yeah, like over 2 years. But they banks can, but they just choose not to.
There you go. And so there is going to be this time frame that even once it is legalized, that you still don't have traditional lenders or traditional banks that are in the game. It's going to be a lot more still specialty lending, organizations like Chicago Atlantic Group, which is a premier leader in this space. And you now have the attention of all the big cannabis companies, which I think is really exciting. I mean, you're a first-stop shop. I mean, I know some very high-level, executive-level. I mean, I know a lot of entrepreneurs that are running these companies that are being bought by the powerhouses, the darlings in the industry, the big names. And I know people that have run those companies that are saying you're the first stop, Chicago Atlantic Group. And so I just think that that's cool. And I wanted to share that, you know, with our audience.
Yeah, no, that I appreciate that. And again, it's been just doing what we say, saying what we do. And ultimately, you know, reputation is a very valuable thing. And it also could be, you're only as good as your last deal. So you always got to do right by, people and do the right thing.
That's awesome. Tony, thank you so much for joining us here today. I appreciate it. This is such a fun, in-depth conversation, not only about your story, but you're a wealth of knowledge on the actual tactical side of things, the actual mechanics of how to get a good return or how to protect yourself from a bad return. And so I thank you. Where can we find out more about you and about Chicago Atlantic Group?
Yeah, you know, I think the best place to start would be, you know, ChicagoAtlantic.com, our website. You know, we have a lot of information on there. If people have, questions, I do like to share knowledge about, debt and so on. They can shoot me an email at tcapple@ChicagoAtlantic.com, which TCAPPELL at ChicagoAtlantic.com.
Awesome. Hey, thanks again. And to our audience, to everyone listening and those of you watching, I just want to again end today's episode the way I end each episode, and that is to challenge you to take some form of action today. Move in the direction of financial freedom and a life by design, a life on your terms, and a life that is inspiring and compelling to live at the highest levels. So we will catch you next week.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Lifestyle Investor Podcast. If you enjoyed today's episode, be sure to subscribe so future episodes are automatically downloaded directly to your device. You can also leave an honest rating and review over on iTunes. Not only do I read every single one, but it also helps me understand what content matters the most to our audience. And if you can think of one or two people who could benefit from this episode, would you share it with them right now? Who knows? Maybe they'll buy you something nice when they make their first million. If you would like access to today's show notes, including links to all the resources mentioned, visit www.justindonald.com/podcast. Thanks again for listening, and I'll catch you next week for another episode of The Lifestyle Investor.